Hey, Truth Seekers, the Gremlins tried again tonight, but we got the better of them. 2 hours in this podcast of Aloy. The first hour was eaten up by monsters. So are we live now? By golly, I believe we are. Good evening, Truth Seekers. Mike Malloy here on the NoVem Radio Network. Sorry about that first hour. We were just so intrigued with what we did the other night, we had to play it again. We are now, we're back to live. And glad you hung around, the six or seven of you who did. just a minor problem here. We had massive rainstorms here in Atlanta, and Atlanta area, but where our studio is. So apparently we had another. Eventually, what we're going to do is plant some strategically placed explosive charges here in the studio, and get back about a quarter mile and blow this son of a bitch up and put a new one in. So in the meantime, hi, welcome to Friday. All sorts of items on the agenda tonight, and I want to try to cover as many as we can here in the 2 hours that we have left. Do you remember what was it, Kathy? About a couple of years ago, or less, maybe only 18 months, 24 months. There was an operation, a company put together out in Utah called Clean Flicks, F-L-I-X, Clean Flicks. Remember that? It was a business that made a big deal about the fact that they were going to get DVDs released, movies released on DVD by Hollywood, and take those movies and clean them up. Get out the nasty words and the sex scenes, and in other words, just tamper with other people's artistic work. Now, if they didn't agree with the work, it didn't make any difference. They would take the DVDs. If somebody was selling a DVD, they would remaster it and take out the stuff that the person wanted taken out. So, they ran into a real problem with this. There were a number of lawsuits, including one, a huge one, filed by 16 directors in Hollywood, including Steven Spielberg and Robert Redford, Disney, Sony, Universal, Paramount, 20th Century Fox. They all said, you know, are you out of your mind? It was the business was a favorite of conservative politicians because, I mean, what a wonderful thing to do, right? Get somebody else's movie that was made by directors and writers and all sorts of people that go into making a movie, not to mention the actors, and just totally crap it up, totally alter it to fit your concept of morality. Now, of course, if you really are interested in finding fault with a movie, the obvious first thought would be don't see it. just don't rent it. Don't go to the theater. Don't buy it when it comes out on DVD. My God, how simple is that? But this is conservative, dominated, fascist, religious right, wacko America, 2008. Well, this is back in, I think it was 2005, early 2006. Anyway, it went to court, and in 2006, the film industry won its copyright claims against Clean Flicks, and the company recently shut down, supposedly due to the film industry's legal force. So what happened to the company and its founder, Daniel Thompson? You're way ahead of me on this, aren't you, Tuesday? Huh? You know where this is going! Ah! Well, in the past week, you might want to cover your eyes for this one. The founder of this religiously conservative film scrubbing company has been arrested and accused of having sex with underage girls. According to the Salt Lake Tribune, the arrest warrants and booking documents state that Mr. Thompson got a couple of 14-year-olds into his place of business. He told them that his film sanitizing business was a cover for a pornography studio. When police went in, they found what the Salt Lake City newspaper says is a large quantity of porno movies, along with a keg of beer, painkillers, two cameras hooked to a television. Mr. Thompson has been released after posting a $30,000 bail. According to the booking documents, these two girls, and by the way, the David Thompson is 31, and his partner, Isaac Lifferth, 24, they were arrested in Orem, Utah, this past week. Orem police say the teenagers wanted to earn money to move out of their homes, and so they offered sexual favors to men. Wait a minute, isn't this Mormon land? Oh, well. According to booking documents, the girls asked a 16-year-old friend to put them in touch with anyone who would pay for sex. So the 16-year-old sent out text messages to several friends, and Mr. Lifferth responded. And he arranged to meet both girls on January 19th in Orem, Utah. And then he traveled to an apartment with them where he paid each girl $20 for oral sex, according to the documents. The 14-year-olds contacted this man again a few days later for additional work. Mr. Lifferth asked the girls to go with him to a club and perform oral sex on Daniel Thompson, the guy who was ran the film sanitizing business. Thompson took them to the back of the store where they met and asked if they were of legal age. The girls said they were 18. They engaged in oral sex with Thompson, and then they left the store, and they got $20 each. Well, the scheme was exposed when one of the girls' mothers found one of the 20s and asked, "Where'd you get the money?" So Mr. Thompson, the religious conservative and scrubber of those nasty movies, and his partner were booked into the Utah County Jail on suspicion of sexual abuse and unlawful sex with a 14-year-old. It always happens this way, doesn't it? Huh? You knew this was going to happen, didn't Kathy? A couple years ago, when we talked about the story, didn't we say after the show, "Watch, this miserable son of a bitch will wind up being a child molester." Here he is. Speaking of child molesting and pornography, ExxonMobil has posted the largest annual profit in the history of U.S. capitalism, bar none, factoring in inflation, everything you can think of in the history of the United States, in the history of business, capitalism, everything, in a partridge in a pear tree, ExxonMobil, $40.6 billion last year. That's profit. That's just profit. That's profit. That's not gross sales. That's profit. Exxon also set a record for the biggest quarterly profit. The last 3 months of 2007, $11.7 billion, which beats its own previous record of $10.7 billion in the fourth quarter of 2005. The previous record for annual profit by an American corporation was $39.5 billion. In 2006, which was held by, you guessed it, ExxonMobil. Hey, how do you like that, huh? Isn't it good to live in a country where we have these kinds of winners? Son of a bitch, man, it just makes me happy as a pig in feces to think about, there's ExxonMobil. Well, I may not be able to pay the rent. I may not have health insurance. And my company, just gave me 60 days pay and said goodbye. But by God, I live in a country that can produce that kind of profit. I think the free enterprise capitalist system is just wonderful. It's just a damn shame it never touches me or my wife or the people down the street or my cousins or my aunts and uncles or anybody I know. Of course, we all know that someday we can make $40 billion too. So we're just going to keep voting for Republicans. Because, by God, the Democrats want to do stuff like, oh, I don't know, force us to have health insurance and try to get us out of wars and maybe seek alternative energy. I don't know what that crap's all about, but I am so glad I live in the United States of, by God, America, where a good red-blooded, publicly traded American corporation like ExxonMobil can make $40 billion. Son of a bitch, you know, someday I'm going to do that too.
Tonight, why can't it all be like it was before? How can I explain why mommy's not here anymore? 'Cause daddy likes porno and $10 whores. Daddy gets wasted and robs liquor stores. Daddy likes rubbing against little boys on the bus. I think that's why your mommy left us.
It's a fine looking bird, isn't it?
Don't just start away on these days. You poor old son, you see.
21 past the hour. There has been some talk, most of it on the internet, of course. Mainstream media doesn't touch stories like this at all. But a lot of talk about the signing statements Bush made regarding some bills that were just passed by Congress. You might as well have said that the signing statements were applied to his State of the Union address, which, of course, is kind of silly. But one of them, 24 hours after talking about clean coal the other night. When was that? Monday night? Was that Monday night, the State of the Union? The next day. Here's what happened. Bush has talked about clean coal technology, and I don't know what the hell clean coal technology is. There's no such thing. I guess he's talking about scrubbers inside the smokestacks when coal is burned to convert it to usable energy. Unless I'm missing something, coal is pure carbon, isn't it? I mean, just about. Well, what the hell is clean coal? Well, there is no such thing. If somebody wants to send me an email and say, well, Malloy here, this is from page 964 of the Engineer's Guide to Coal Technology, fine, you know, I'll look at it. But anyway, he's talked about clean coal technology as a solution to global warming, which is asinine. It's just totally asinine, but that's Bush. Last year, in 2006, he insisted that the U.S. was spending quite a bit of money. Here's what he said. We're spending quite a bit of money here at the federal level to come up with clean coal technologies. That was in 2006. Now, during Monday's State of the Union, Bush said, let us fund new technologies that can operate coal power while capturing carbon emissions, end quote. But 24 hours after he said that, Bush's Secretary of Energy, Samuel Bodman, indicated that the White House was pulling the plug on the project. It was called FutureGen. FutureGen. Hey, I like that. A clean coal plant that was touted as the cleanest fossil fuel plant, fired power plant in the world. It's also now been disconnected. Representative Timothy Johnson, who's a Republican from Illinois, said there was a meeting in Illinois where this thing was going to be, this power plant. Republican Tim Johnson said that Bodman told this group of representatives that he had planned to disband FutureGen and go in another direction. And at one point during this talk, Johnson and Bodman snapped at each other. Oh, my goodness. At another point, U.S. Rep. Rahm Emanuel, a Chicago Democrat, a DLC Democrat who I can't stand, but Rahm Emanuel told Bodman that, quote, the first action taken by the president after the State of the Union was a series of broken promises, end quote. Dick Durbin, the senator from Illinois, said, in 25 years on Capitol Hill, I have never witnessed such a cruel deception. Durbin went on to say, when the city of Mattoon, Illinois, was chosen over possible locations in Texas for this plant, At that moment, the Secretary of Energy set out to kill the Future Gen project. The Center for American Progress senior fellow Robert Sussman notes that companies and governments around the world have committed to supporting Future Gen. Everybody said, yeah, okay, we'll do it. Jesus God, the American government's going to sign on to clean coal. Okay. Sussman said it would be a blow to future international public and private partnerships if the Bush administration were to allow these commitments to languish. And the Washington Post now reports that the Illinois lawmakers intend to appeal the decision directly to President Bush, and that Dick Durbin, a Democratic senator, one of the Democratic senators from Illinois, said that, quote, I might block nominations to fill two key vacancies in the Energy Department, end quote. Dick, as much as I love you, you're a Democrat, you're a senator, you know, you cried in the Senate after you made true statements about the U.S. Military commitment in Iraq, but you're a pansy Democrat, just like you're a tutu Democrat, as Bart Kopp calls them, pink tutu Democrats. You're not going to block nominations for anybody. When George Bush or Mr. Bodman or Dick Cheney or anybody else in the Bush administration says, 24 hours after making a big show about clean coal technology, that they're going to kill the program, Senator Durbin, the program will be killed. And you will do, as a Democratic senator, what is required of you. Shut up. Well, make your statement. And then after you've made your statement about how you're going to withhold nominations for vacancies, then shut up, sit down, and going back to doing what National Democrats do in the House and the Senate. And that is taking your orders, pretending like you're going to fight and resist, and then give up. That's what Democrats do these days. We'll be back after the break. I'm Mike Malloy. Stay with us.
There's one way to escape. Be prepared to meet the Lord. When the mushroom of destruction falls, there is a shielding sword. He will surely stand beside you, and you'll never taste of death. For your soul will fly to safety and eternal peace and rest. Are you ready for that great atomic power? You're out.
Free and future, it's Mike Malloy.
25 before the hour. Oh, and speaking of ExxonMobil, Shell, Royal Dutch Shell, reignited anger, it says here, over excessive profits after revealing today that it made $27.6 billion in dollars profit, a new record for a UK company. The announcement comes at times when motorists in UK are paying petrol prices of a pound, one English pound per liter, which is like $8 a gallon. You think we have it rough here? Royal Dutch Shell's profits haul for 2007 was 9% higher than a year ago, and comes after the price of crude rose toward $100 US a barrel. Oh God. Okay, now what do I have here? Somebody sent me something from Business Wire. CleanFlix, the company that started the edited movies, CleanFlix denies media reports and allegations. Company is not affiliated in any way with Daniel Deem Thompson, a convicted felon recently arrested for sexual abuse charges. It says Ray Lines, the co-founder and partner of CleanFlix LLC and its successor company, CleanFlix Media Incorporated, said the following, quote, let me be perfectly clear about this. Daniel Dean Thompson, a twice convicted felon who was recently arrested in Orem, Utah on charges of forcible sexual abuse and unlawful sexual activity of the 14-year-old, was not a founder of any CleanFlix entity. In addition, Thompson has never been a partner, officer, affiliate, dealer, franchisee, collaborator, consultant, or representative of any CleanFlix entity in any capacity. Any news report or allegation to the contrary is false and is harmful to CleanFlix, the only internet DVD rental site exclusively offering family-friendly movie rentals. As such, we respectfully ask all journalists, bloggers, and media outlets to please correct any inaccurate or false information they may have inadvertently or inaccurately published in the past, suggesting a false relationship between CleanFlix and Daniel Dean Thompson. Thank you. End quote. Okay. Congress is now calling for hearings on what Bush does with his signing statements. Barbara Lee of the Congressional Progressive Caucus sent a letter to Nancy Pelosi requesting that appropriate committee chairs quickly schedule oversight hearings regarding the recent Bush signing statement that would circumvent a key provision in the Defense Authorization Act, the one they just signed about providing, you know, the Democrats go along with providing hundreds of billions of dollars for this psychopath in the White House. Bush has decided, the bill said there would be no permanent military presence in Iraq, and Bush said, screw you, yes, there will be. So, excuse me, the letter, co-authored by Congresswomen Lee, Lynn Wolsey, and Maxine Waters, states, quote, we believe that Congress must find out, and the American public made aware, of the serious consequences of long-term military basing agreements or treaties that bypass congressional action. In addition, it is critical to shed light on the implications of the president's signing statements and intention to ignore the law. At the same time, the statement says, it is also imperative to give greater scrutiny to the Bush administration's efforts to maintain a long-term or indefinite military presence in Iraq. Holding Harry's hearings will complement the 166 hearings on Iraq that Democrats have held since you became our speaker in January 2007. And it goes on here. But here's another complete non-starter. So the Congress wants hearings because, but you know, Bush says things that are absolute lies. We were talking about this last night. You know, all the people out there who think I'm a dumbass because I don't accept the official 9/11 statements about what happened in this country. And my polite response to that is screw you. You know, I'm supposed to believe the one horrendous event that triggered all the other horrendous events when I know full well that everything this filthy president has said has been a lie. Every single thing he does is a lie. This is the most blatant liar in the history of this republic. And let's see, why do we impeach Clinton? Oh, that's right, for lying about oral sex. Ooh, okay. God have mercy. But as far as the Congress doing something about it, that's not going to happen. There is no way. There won't be hearings about this. Who's going to come? Who in the Bush crime family will show up? And what happens when Congress issues subpoenas, like to Harriet Myers, or who is the other freak? That White House aide, and they just wave their middle finger at Congress and say to hell with you, you know, it's executive privilege, or we're just not going to show up. And then what does the Congress do? Oh, okay, well, we're sorry we bothered you. Now, the only good thing that Barbara Lee and Lynn Wolsey and Maxine Waters accomplish here is that in writing these letters to Pelosi, And making this stuff public somewhere in the congressional record, wherever they make it public, at least 30 or 40 years from now, when people may, if they're still a United States, get serious about what this son of a bitch did, this Bush crime family, there will be a paper trail of a sort. There will at least be a record of what was attempted. Now, it will be an incomplete record. That's why impeachment is so critical. Not that Bush would be convicted, he wouldn't. Because there are enough Republicans in the House that don't give a goddamn if Bush raped a three-year-old and butchered his own mother. They still would not convict him of anything. They simply wouldn't. Because Republicans are non-humans in Congress. They are. They're there to enrich themselves. They don't give a damn about America. They don't give a damn about families. They don't give a damn about workers. They couldn't care about anything. They just don't care. That's why impeachment is important. And as far as Pelosi and now Waxman and Gerald Nadler and all these Democrats whose asses I'd like to kick up around their shoulders, I truly would. Oh, my boy, what is that? Threatening a member of Congress? Uh-oh. They are standing in the way of impeachment. Gerald Nadler in New York. Waxman in California. No matter how many times Dennis Kucinich or Robert Wexler or any of these people are saying, look, we've got to impeach them. The gatekeepers say, no, I don't think so. Nancy Pelosi, Harry Reid. So there will be no record. Who's going to put together the record? There is a record. There's a record out there from the internet bloggers and a few enterprising journalists who are still left in this godforsaken news media. They're still out there. That record is still out there. But a congressional record, a record that shows that the elected representatives of this country try to do something to stop this Nazi bastard, and it won't be there. It won't be there. There will be no official transcript. There will be no official impeachment proceedings. There will be articles. There will be books written. There will be that kind of a record. But that doesn't mean anything. So Barbara Lee, co-chair of the Congressional Progressive Caucus, and Lynn Woolsey and Maxine Waters, thank you, madams, for making the effort, writing the letter. But nothing will happen. And you know it, and I know it, and more importantly, the Bush crime family knows it. Nothing will happen. Got an email here from Scott who about the union. We brought up unions. You know, why are a couple of unions backing Hillary Clinton when Hillary Clinton has never, ever, 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 ever been pro-union? Ever. Under any circumstances, ever been pro-union. Ever. Scott writes, Mike, keep in mind that it's not the union members who are endorsing Clinton. It's the leadership of these so-called unions. What is left of the unions is now in bed with the corporations. They don't work for the members. Perfect example would be the Service Employees Union. I was indirectly involved with them through my job, even though my department wasn't part of the union. We were required to go with the union contract. There was a clause in the contract that indicated, because of the consolidation of Hospital Corporation of America's hospital accounting debts, that if our jobs were to end before a two-year window period of the announcement of the potential layoffs, the employees would get $10,000 in severance pay. I got the first $1,500, but when my job ended, the hospital claimed it was due to budget cuts and not because of the announced layoffs, as they claim. Therefore, HCA did not have to pay the rest of the severance. When I tried to get the union involved in this matter, all they would do is give me the runaround about them not being able to find the original contract. The union couldn't find the original. Oh, Jesus. My point being is that unions don't represent the workers anymore, so it should come as no surprise that unions would endorse Hillary. Yeah, well, I had the same experience with AFTRA, the American Federation of Television and Radio Actors. Is that what it stands for? Artists, television, radio artists? I don't even know. I pay a lot of money as dues to AFTRA. And when Air America fired me in violation of my contract and the contract they had with AFTRA, AFTRA did nothing. And it's been, what's it been now, Kathy, a year and a half? Almost 2 years? Nothing. So I understand. The only reason I pay dues to AFTRA is because I pretty much have to. I guess I don't have to, but I do get health insurance through that union. It only costs me about $2,500 a year, so I guess I can't, you know, I can't complain too much. But I've gotten to the point that Scott's gotten to. I'm pro-union, but not the way they're run now.
You bum peanuts.
Oh, shit.
fly higher, it's more of Mike Malloy.
Ten before the hour. I watched some television today because I've got this cold and spent a lot of time just lazing around the house, which I hate to do, but I watched some television today, and I was watching the political commentators, the chattering classes, talking about who has endorsed Barack Obama or who has endorsed Hillary Clinton. And it just so pisses me off. It's very dangerous for someone like me to sit and spend a better part of a day flipping back and forth between the news channels, so-called, and not hear anything substantive. Like one of the serious lies that Hillary Clinton told last night in this love fest between her and Barack Obama, which really was kind of sickening on just about all fronts. I know Barack was trying not to get sucked into it, but Hillary would have none of that. I even had to listen. I didn't have to, but I listened to something today where an expert on body language and vocality, whatever you call it, the study of vocal patterns, stress, vocalization, so on and so forth. And this expert on whatever channel it was making the point that Hillary Clinton had some sort of a epiphany or something, because last night on the stage with Barack Obama, she was just this absolutely control. Her body language, her gestures, her vocal nuances were those taken together, were those of somebody who has already been coronated, who is already in the king's chair, or in her case, the queen's chair. And, you know, so I spend the day listening to this stuff, and I wonder, is anybody going to talk about the issues? Is anybody going to talk seriously about the position these two have? And the quick answer is no, of course not. This is America. This is United States of America, 2008. No issues. Andy Borowitz, writing at the Borowitz Report, kind of put it all together from last night. And under the headline, Hillary, Obama, get a room. And Borowitz writes, after 2 hours of a televised debate that many pundits characterized as a love fest, Democratic presidential candidates Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton confirmed today that they have gotten a room. Mr. Obama and Ms. Clinton secured a room at the Hollywood Roosevelt Hotel, conveniently located near the Kodak Theater, where the CNN debate took place. The extraordinary announcement came on the heels of a request made by millions of television viewers who emailed CNN last night urging the Democrat rivals to get a room. In a joint statement released by Mrs. Clinton and Mr. Obama this morning, the two presidential contenders said, quote, we have heard the voters loud and clear asking us to get a room, and we have gotten that room, end quote. After the couple released a photo of themselves in fluffy white hotel bathrobes, there was a palpable sense of relief in Democratic circles that the two senators had, in fact, gotten a room. DNC Chairman Howard Dean said, quote, it was a little uncomfortable watching the two of them up there together, barely keeping their hands off each other. The sexual tension was so thick you could cut it with a knife, end quote. As news spread of the candidate's decision to get a room, pundits speculated about what role former Bill Clinton might play in such a room. Hillary biographer Carl Bernstein said, quote, I don't see him playing a role there. I think Bill Clinton respects the right of someone to get a room, end quote. Elsewhere, Borowitz writes, advisors to GOP frontrunner John McCain have urged him to stop speaking in that spooky voice. Andy Borowitz at the Borowitz Report. And the odd part is, I have retained nothing today about who has endorsed Hillary. I know that Schwarzenegger has endorsed John McCain. Frankly, I don't care about that cluster grope among Republicans. I couldn't care less. And as far as Democrats are concerned, why not tell me, since I'm part of the American public and I'm going to vote, tell me what I need to know about these two candidates. Of course, that's a little bit disingenuous of me, because since I'm in this business and I do a lot of online research, and a lot of you send me stuff to clear my head about where it concerns these candidates, I already know what they stand for. And truly, you know, be pissed off. I really don't care. I've already pissed off most Democrats because of my ugly stance on the Democratic Party, because I still believe in the Democratic Party as the Democratic Party and not this horrifying hybrid, this half-beast, half-DNC it's become. But as far as Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton are concerned, there's not a dime's worth of difference between the two to... Oh, my God, I'm going back to George Wallace's statement. And as far as John McCain, if you take McCain, Obama, and Clinton, there's no difference. They're all the same. But sticking to the Democratic side, Clinton and Obama are both corporate candidates. They're corporate candidates. And I guess that's what we're going to have. You know, some of us old-style progressives, if that's what we are just going to have to accept this. You know, what do you want to do? What do you want to do? You people who really, really, really believe in putting America back in the hands of the people, what do you want to do? Do you want armed revolution? Because that's pretty much what it's going to take, and that's probably a 30-year process and a lot of blood and disaster and death and destruction. So, no, that's out, right? We did that. We did that back in the 1860s. So what's left? Another example, I guess, of the lesser of two evils is that usually it's the Democrat or the Republican, which is the lesser of two evils. This time, apparently, where it concerns Barack and Hillary, it's you got to make that choice between the two of them. I'm sure they're wonderful people. You know, I'd love to go have a beer with Barack Obama or go to a movie with Hillary Clinton. Isn't that what the Republicans said about George Bush all those years ago? But as far as being the leader of the United States, when this country has become a corporatist state, there's just a few more T's to cross and I's to dot, and it'll be a done deal, a fait accompli, unlike any that ever started this way, because no other government really ever started this way. And here we are. We'll see it in our lifetime. So Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama, they'll be the ones to dot the I's, cross the T's. We'll be back after the break. I'm Mike Malloy. The hour. I want to remind people in the Phoenix area, we have a big event coming up Saturday, February 23rd. I'm going to be there with Scott Ritter. There are tickets on sale now. If you would like to attend, go to 1480kphx.com. 1480kphx.com. It's going to be a blowout. I understand ticket sales, according to the folks in Phoenix, have been very brisk. There are some left. I don't think they're that expensive. Matter of fact, I think it's not, under 20 bucks. But Scott Ritter and I, Saturday evening, February 23rd, for what may turn out to be, I don't know what it's going to turn out to be. I have no idea. I just know that it's going to be an interesting night. So if you haven't gotten tickets yet and you live in the Phoenix area, or if you don't live in the Phoenix area, you know, some of you rich liberals, if you live in Portland or Seattle, buy tickets, get yourself a plane flight, and fly into Phoenix. Come on by. I don't know if you saw this or not. I saw it this morning, or heard it this morning. Internet traffic in the Middle East has been severely disrupted, interrupted. Now, I don't know if it's still going on, because I have heard nothing else about it all day. Now, that doesn't mean that there hasn't been a big broadcast. Everything's fixed now, but here's what I heard. That three undersea cables off the coast of Egypt had been severed. And they didn't know how they'd been severed. But the result has been what is being referred to as unprecedented mass internet outages throughout the Middle East and Asia. And of course, all of us who have a tinfoil hat in our bedroom closets are now suspicious that a major event of geopolitical proportions may be just around the corner. Here's what it says. You can get this information at internettraffic.com. Iran has been completely cut off from the internet, although apparently Ahmadinejad's blog can still be accessed. I have no idea. Also, blackouts are impacting large chunks of Asia, the Middle East, North Africa. The most severe problems are occurring in India, Pakistan, Bahrain, Kuwait, the United Arab Emirates, Qatar, Saudi Arabia, and Egypt. Interestingly, Israel and Iraq are unaffected by the outage. Israel and Iraq are unaffected. Stephen Beckett, who is an analyst with Telegeography, a research company that consults on global internet issues, said the damaged cables collectively account for the majority of international communications between Europe and the Middle East. Apparently, CNN reported on that. Like I say, I must have missed that. Well, here it is. High technology services across large tracts of Asia, the Middle East, North Africa, crippled today. Following blah, 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 blah. All right, so CNN, and this story was updated at, this is yesterday. Was this yesterday? Today? I don't even know. Is it still out? Maybe Ben Birch, if internet guy is, or our podcast guy is listening, maybe he can send me an email. Officials say that the cause behind the severing of the cables remains unknown. The UAE, second largest telecom company, said the cables were cut due to ships dragging their anchors. Oh, yeah? oh, really? Not submarines, huh? At whatreallyhappened.com, Mike Rivero, writing there, points out that the mysterious cable sabotage, if that's what it is, could portend another imperial neocon crusade in the works. Mike Rivero writes, quote, "The biggest problem the Bush administration faced during Iraq were images coming over the internet that showed the horrors being visited on the Iraqi people and exposing the government's lies about Saddam." So I don't know. Has it all been taken care of? Is it all fixed now? Huh? I don't even know. Now, last night, let's see. If we are on the brink of World War IX or whatever the hell Bush wants done, you know, interesting. He puts a signing statement on the military appropriations bill that says, "I don't have to do any of this." Last night, Hillary Clinton said, quote, regarding Iraq, quote, "We bombed them for days in 1998 because Saddam Hussein threw out the inspectors," end quote. Now, she said that in because, you know, she doesn't want anyone to think that she's soft on terrorism or whatever. So that's what she said. "We bombed them, Iraq, for days in 1998 because Saddam Hussein threw out the inspectors," end quote. Now, let me see a show of hands. How many people know that that is a lie? Huh? Do I see any hands? Norman Solomon, who is the executive director of the Institute for Public Accuracy and is the author of War Made Easy, How Presidents and Pundits Keep Spinning Us to Death, plus whose work appears all over the internet. Common Dreams, Truth Out. I've quoted him so many times, I feel like I owe him residuals. But here's what Norman Solomon said today. If facts matter, then it should matter that Hillary Clinton chose to rely on such a basic falsehood during the debate when she flatly stated, quote, "We bombed them for days in 1998 because Saddam Hussein threw out the inspectors," end quote. In fact, just prior to the Clinton administration's several days of bombing Iraq in December 1998, the United Nations weapons inspectors left Iraq when UNSCOM, the weapons inspectors, had Richard Butler withdrew them because the Clinton administration made it clear that the U.S. government was about to start bombing. Yeah, now see, I remember that. And Hillary Clinton wants me to think that my mind is somehow screwed up. I'm sorry, Mrs. Clinton, it is not. Solomon goes on to say, quote, that false statement by Hillary Clinton during the debate Thursday came as she was trying to verbally navigate what were her most difficult moments on the night, of the night, last night, about her vote for the October 2002 congressional resolution that authorized an invasion of Iraq. At that point in the debate last night, she was arguing that she had made what she called, quote, a reasonable judgment, end quote, which assumed that Saddam Hussein had a record of blocking inspectors so they couldn't find his weapons of mass destruction. In the process, her extreme distortion of history, asserting that the four-year absence of UN inspectors from Iraq was because Saddam threw out inspectors in December 1998, that distortion of history goes to the core of her candor about the lead-up to the invasion of Iraq and her rationale for voting to authorize it. Any journalist, Solomon writes, interested in fact-checking Senator Clinton's claim that we bombed them for days in 1998 because Saddam threw out the inspectors, would be well advised to stick to relying on the original reportage of what occurred in December 1998. Because since then, a self-referential myth has developed in retrospective news coverage of those events, with journalists and politicians alike frequently recycling the false assertion that the four-year absence of UN inspectors from Iraq began when Saddam kicked them out of the country. See, this is for you Hillary supporters. I mean, how do you square that? Are you going to tell me that Hillary doesn't remember what happened in 1998? Are you going to tell me that she doesn't really mean what she meant when she voted for the authorization of Bush to use force against Iraq? How are you going to convince me of that? Well, I'll tell you right now, you're not. You're not. Stephen Zunes, who has recently written a series of articles on the candidates and their foreign policy positions. Stephen Zunes is well known he's a Middle East editor for Foreign Policy in Focus. He's a professor of politics, University of San Francisco, author of a couple of books on this region. He said, Senator Clinton, in Thursday night's debate, claims that she voted to authorize war against Iraq because, quote, we needed to put inspectors in, end quote. However, Zunes writes, Saddam Hussein had by that time already agreed to a return of the weapons inspectors. Furthermore, Senator Clinton voted against the Levin Amendment, which would have granted authority to invade Iraq if Saddam defied subsequent UN demands. That was the Carl Levin Amendment. Instead, Senator Clinton voted to give President Bush the authority to invade Iraq at the time and circumstance of his own choosing, regardless of whether inspectors returned. Indeed, Zunes writes, unfettered inspections had been going on in Iraq for months at the time the Bush administration launched the invasion that Senator Clinton had voted to authorize, unquote. Now, this is also what Scott Ritter had said over and over and over again. For any of these senators, for anybody to say that the ones that voted for the authorization for Bush, that they did it because of this or because of that, is an absolute lie. They know it. I know it. You should know it. Media knows it. So why do we let them get away with it? Why did Wolf Blitzer sit there with that dumbass look on his face last night and allow Hillary Clinton to say that and never come back? Well, you know the answer to that, don't you? Hour. This is the Malloy program on Nova M Radio. Now, that was Hillary's nonsense from last night. And either Hillary Clinton says stuff like that because she's deliberately lying, or because she figures it's okay to lie because the American public doesn't remember anything back from 1998. Oh, my God, it's 10 years ago. Or she doesn't remember. If she doesn't remember a directive that was issued by her husband, she's the one that talks about 35 years experience. She's the one that talks about a co-presidency by innuendo. If she doesn't remember that, then I don't think she should be elected president. Do you? Now, Barack Obama, back in August, he wrote an op-ed piece for the New York Daily News. Let me quote a little bit from it. This is August 30th, 2007. He writes, Americans, this is a tough stance against the tyrant of Tehran. Hit Iran where it hurts was Barack's title on this, I think. He writes, Americans need to come together to confront the challenge posed by Iran. Yet the Bush administration and an anonymous senator are blocking a bill with bipartisan support that would ratchet up the pressure on the Iranian regime. It's time for this obstructionism to stop. He goes on to talk about a strengthened Iran, which now poses the greatest strategic challenge to U.S. interests in the Middle East in a generation. Holy cow, really? He goes on to say, Iran supports violent groups and sectarian politics in Iraq, fuels terror and extremism across the Middle East, and continues to make progress on its nuclear program in defiance of the international community. Meanwhile, Barack writes, Iran's President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad has declared that Israel must be, quote, wiped off the map, end quote. How many times does that lie have to be shot down? Mahmoud Ahmadinejad is no friend of Israel's. And for certain specific reasons. But how many times does that lie that he said Israel has to be wiped off the map have to be reexamined? Now, is Barack Obama repeating the lie because he's stupid? Is he doing it because he doesn't know what the real statement was? Or is he doing it because he's trying to please a certain constituency in this country, i.e. the Israel lobby? Or because he wants the non-Israel lobby in the United States to think he's a real tough ass, even though he's only had not even one term in the United States Senate, and by God, he will do the same thing that George Bush the first did to Iraq. I mean, the phrasing is almost the same. When he says that Iran now poses the greatest strategic challenge to U.S. interests in the Middle East in a generation. Doesn't that sound like George Herbert Walker Bush back in 1990 and 1991? In his piece, Barack Obama goes on, as president, I will use all elements of American power. That's pretty clear what he means, isn't it? Isn't that like Bush or the rest of these thugs saying all options are on the table where it concerns force against Iran? Barack says, as president, I will use all elements of American power to pressure the Iranian regime, including the power of tough, smart, and principled diplomacy. That's not the subjective phrase, but in the sentence. It's not the primary clause. It's not the primary clause. The primary clause is I will use all elements of American power to pressure the Iranian regime. Now, when he talks about Iran fuels terror and extremism across the Middle East, does he not understand that the U.S. presence there is fueling it? The Israel policy against the Palestinians is fueling it? The Israeli policy against Lebanon is fueling it? What the hell is he talking about? Is he being a liar? Is he being disingenuous? Or is he being a typical corporate American candidate for the office of the presidency? You tell me. I'm just asking the questions, okay? He says, for diplomacy to work, we need to dial up pressure, not just tough talk. Iran's troubling behavior
depends in large part on access to billions of dollars in oil and gas revenue. Where have we heard this before?
You raise the blade. You make the change. You rearrange me till I'm sane. You lock the door. Throw away the key. There's someone in my...
Monkey Right Blues, here's the cure, Mike Malloy.
Over, 25 before the hour. Barack Obama, writing last August for the New York Daily News in an op-ed piece about hitting Iran where it hurts. Now, this is the same Barack Obama who said he would sit down and talk with Ahmadinejad and immediately got an awful lot of flack from Hillary Clinton. Between the two of these people, Obama and Clinton, it's just, you know, they're playing ping pong with my brain, and I'm just sick of it. That's what Bush and Cheney have done. So Barack goes on to say in this piece, for diplomacy to work, we need to dial up our political and economic pressure. He's referring to Iran. Iran's troubling behavior depends in large part on access to billions of dollars in oil and gas revenue. That is why I introduced the Iran Sanctions Enabling Act in May of 2007 to build on a movement across the country to divest from companies that do significant business with Iran. This would send a clear message about where America stands, increasing Iran's isolation and hitting the Iranian regime where it hurts. Sam Brownback, a Republican senator and presidential candidate at the time, joined me in introducing this bill. Sam Brownback? He goes on to say, talking tough and keeping our troops in the middle of Iraq's civil war has only served to strengthen Iran's position. That's true. It's time to turn the page on a failed foreign policy. It's time for strong diplomacy backed by common sense measures that pressure the Iranian regime. This makes, it makes no sense. It just makes no sense. If the policies of the Bush crime family have been egregious and entirely wrong, which they have been, Barack Obama wants to do the same where it concerns Iran. I know Hillary Clinton does. Why are these people not addressing the real problem, which, first of all, is a U.S. military presence in a place where we don't belong? No, that's second. First is the uneven-handed approach used to the Israeli-Palestinian issue for the past half century. Why does nobody seem, none of these politicians seem willing to confront that? They do understand it. They know why Iran backs so-called terrorist organizations. They understand that. They know why Israel has built a wall. They know why there's a wall on the Gaza-Egypt border, also built by Israel. They understand, these politicians. Hillary Clinton knows what's going on. Barack Obama knows what's going on. When are they going to act in the best interests of the United States and not in the best interests of Likud in Israel? Can someone answer that for me? Nah, you just write off the question as the ravings of an anti-Semite. Well, if that's your attitude, screw you, too. June 2007, Washington Post. Democrat Barack Obama and Republican Mitt Romney, neither of whom is burdened by much foreign policy history on the national stage, seem to be on the same page together. These two candidates, according to Fred Hyatt, writing in the Post, June 4th, 2007, these two candidates have laid out their foreign policy visions in parallel articles released last week prior to publication in the July-August issue of Foreign Affairs. After you cut through some of their campaign rhetoric, here's what you find. One, the two candidates' programs are strikingly similar to each other. Two, both are strikingly similar to Bush administration policy. Three, and both, far from retreating to isolationism in the face of Iraq and other challenges, set forth their own wildly ambitious calls for American leadership and the promotion of American values. Boldness is an operative word for both of them. Obama begins, quote, after Iraq, we may be tempted to turn inward. That would be a mistake. The American moment is not over, but it must be seized anew, end quote. Obama dwells on Bush's failures and the value of diplomacy and endorses a phased withdrawal of U.S. troops from Iraq. But Obama would maintain in Iraq enough troops, quote, to protect American personnel and facilities, continue training Iraqi security forces, and root out al-Qaeda, end quote. Jesus, God, how many is that going to take? 150,000 right now doesn't appear to be enough. Both Romney and Obama want bigger, not smaller armed forces. Obama calls for an additional 92,000 ground troops, Romney for 100,000. Obama says, quote, to defeat al-Qaeda, I will build a 21st century military and 21st century partnerships as strong as the anti-communist alliance that won the Cold War to stay on the offense everywhere from Djibouti to Kandahar. This is Barack Obama talking. I will build a 21st century military. In both of these candidates' cases, the criticism is not that Bush took on too much, but that he accomplished too little. Obama writes in Foreign Affairs, we can be this America again. He's referring to the America of the Pax Americana, the Imperial Americana, without walking into buzzsaws like Iraq. He says, we can be that America again, this America again. An America that battles immediate evils, promotes an ultimate good, and leads the world once more. So, if you want a summary of these parallel articles in Foreign Affairs last summer, written by Mitt Romney and Barack Obama, you want a summary? If you're looking for someone who will get our troops out of there, neither of these candidates will. Now, you know, I give you the stuff. You do with it what you want. You know, frankly, I really don't care anymore. I don't. We have become so screwed up, we Americans. And progressives are so desperate for something, anything that's not George Bush or Republicans, that we're going to go for Barack Obama or Hillary Clinton when real progressives have been slowly eliminated. You know it as well as I do. This insidious media, when Hillary Clinton made the same statement about back in 1998, we started bombing because Saddam wouldn't let the inspectors back in. She made that statement to media whore number one, Tim Russert, on Meet the Press a couple of weeks ago. Did Tim Russert challenge her? No. Last night, did Wolf Blitzer challenge her? No. Did Barack Obama challenge her? No. And the statement is a lie. So you tell me. What do you want to do about it? I know what we can do about it, what we usually do about it, what progressives, for the most part, have done for the past 28 years. We will pretend that we have a candidate running in the Democratic Party who is going to lead us out of the wilderness. We have found a Moses or a Joshua who's going to lead us out of the wilderness, out of Egypt, into the wilderness, out of the wilderness, into the promised land. That's what we're going to tell ourselves. And we're going to hope against hope. Oh, my God. I trust Barack. I trust Hillary. And we're going to do it again. And I'm sorry, but I truly believe that the progressive movement in this country, as a viable political force is dead. Do you understand that? It is dead. When somebody like Dennis Kucinich, and to a lesser degree, John Edwards, cannot get the kind of exposure, the kind of introduction to the American electorate that a Hillary Clinton or a Barack Obama or a Mitt Romney or a John McCain can get. I mean, come on, folks. You're not brain dead. You're not a Fox television viewer. You know what's going on. Come on! The progressive movement is effectively dead. Now, let me qualify that just a little bit. Maybe it's in a state of suspended animation that looks like death. Maybe there's some way to reanimate it. Maybe there's some way to get progressivism up off its deathbed in the next 10, 15, 20 years and turn things around. You think? I guess what I'm saying, and you do what you want, I think what I'm saying is I can no longer delude myself into believing that a Barack Obama or a Hillary Clinton is the progressive candidate for the Democratic Party, for the office of the presidency, that's going to make a damn bit of difference. Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama may be less a disingenuous, sneaky, rat bastard like George Bush is, but do you think, honestly, truth seeker, do you think that the direction and course of this country will change dramatically from where it's been for the past 7 years with Barack Obama or Hillary Clinton president? Do you really believe that? I'm not asking what you're hoping. I'm not asking what you're thinking you wish would happen. Do you really think it will happen? Before the hour, thanks to our crew, Ian Huff, who engineered the program, Billy Foster, our technical director, Ben Birch, the podcast manager, Chris in Minnesota, our senior correspondent, Bob Alexander, our resident philosopher, Catherine Bay, executive producer. And I'm sorry we didn't get to phone calls tonight. The technical screw-ups because of rain and Southern Bell or AT&T. Who in the hell runs everything here now? AT&T? The first hour was a rebroadcast. We were only live the second 2 hours. Let me, Dick here has been holding on for over 2 hours. Dick, I'm sorry about all this tonight. We got a lot of people that held on forever, but go ahead. What's up, pal?
Yeah, well, Mike, you know, Blitzer used to be an APEC lobbyist. That might explain some of his reticence to, you know, dig into these things. But, you know, I rarely hear much concern from the left about our primary adversary, the right-wing mainstream media. I mean, we're always pointing to the Republicans and the Blue Dogs as though they could do anything by themselves. But it's their enablers, the media, that makes it possible to get these guys in office, you know, starting by selecting out who runs and wins these primaries. I mean, they're right. Enemy number one. But worse than that, you know, we also get friendly fire from our own media, like the Nation's David Corn calling the hacking and obstructing of, 13 million some odd votes for Bush that was proven by exit polls. And they had a margin of error. I think it was about less actually than 1%. You know, and he called it conspiracy theory. You know, so,
right.
I couldn't
believe that David Corn would go that far.
Well, I could, because I have a long history of that. I mean, if you want to look at conspiracy theories, go to CTKA, that's Citizens for Truth and the Kennedy Assassination, and go to media on that site, and you can read how the CIA director Bill Casey took over ABC TV for Cap Cities, mostly, I guess, to cover up a major criminal activity they were involved with that the ABC was reporting on. And also be sure and read James Diogenio's 15-page detailed review of Ultimate Sacrifice, which, as far as I can tell, is a limited hangout for the CIA, written by one of our own on President Kennedy's assassination, of course, well promoted by the mainstream media. So there's little or no profit in telling the truth about all these right-wing conspiracy crimes, you know, from JFK to 9/11. So we buy into or accept the media-promoted lies, and the Republicans stay in office instead of going to prison. I mean, if we're not buying into magic bullets, they've got us believing in magic World Trade Center steel frame buildings that the first time in history spontaneously fall into their own footprint because of some small fires that were going out, you know, despite the fact that the owners admitted they blew up Building 7. And eyewitnesses in the basements of Buildings 1 and 2 got blown up as well and reported it. So, you know, that's complicity in an administration crimes, you know, with cover-up aided, as usual, by most recently Bill Clinton.
Well, you know, and what you're saying, Dick, about mainstream media, you're absolutely right. I'm lost about these big stories of the 20th century that make no sense whatsoever, whether it was MLK's assassination, either the Kennedy assassinations, the assassination of Malcolm X, the attempted assassination of George Wallace. I mean, just on and on. So many lies, so much garbage, so much confusion. And to be to attempt to be a rational citizen, I almost said human being, but attempt to be a rational citizen, of this country, I'm starting to feel like, to some degree, what it must have been like in the Soviet Union to try to be, to use logic and rational thought in a country that was known for its great composers, its great musicians, its great artists, its great authors and writers, and all that had to be done in order to sublimate whatever rational, creative thought you had, because you were living under a regime that was just what it was. I mean, it was Soviet Russia. None of it was true. Potemkin villages. What do we have here now? I think about the Soviet Union often. I know it's very easy to make a comparison, and it's kind of sloppy easy to make a comparison between Bush and Cheney and the Nazis. I think there are some people in the Bush administration who would have fit perfectly into the SS, who would have had no problem eliminating huge population groups, and some of them in the Bush administration, for the sport of it. But the real way these people work is just like the Soviet Union. It's very disconcerting. You know what I'm saying? Let's get Dan in from St. Louis. Dan, welcome to the program.
Oh, hello.
Hey, Dan.
How are you doing?
I'm doing all right. I'm doing all right.
I just wanted to say that I'm disappointed that Edwards didn't go to Super Tuesday. And I think it's going to be over for the Democrats. I really do. I hate to say that, but if you get say McCain, Lieberman, or Romney, Rice, they're done for. You know, hey, Edwards was a great choice, and it really is a sad week in history, I guess.
Well, what if the Democratic ticket is Clinton Obama or Obama Clinton?
You know, I really don't think so. It has nothing to do with race and gender. It has to do with politics and policies. And I'm just going to make a prediction right now. They've lost again. You know, look what happened to Howard Dean. Howard Dean would have been a great president. I think he would have made it all the way through. And the media tore him to shreds. And they treated John Edwards like he didn't even exist. And I saw a poll in my state, Missouri, that before John Edwards dropped out, that had John Edwards at 30%. So you tell me what's going on. So
well,
that's my prediction.
Hey, listen, we got to go. I'm sorry, Dan. I let the clock get away from me. Y'all have a great weekend, okay? I'll see you Monday night. Oh, and Kevin Kenny, have a great weekend wherever you are. Take care, folks. Keep it lit. I'm Mike Malloy.